Welcome to the SomTV Podcast. My name is Jason Wise. I assume this isn't your first time listening, so you know who I am. I am the director of Armageddon and Con Air and The Rock and the Som movies. All good films. Anyways, today we licensed a few movies on SomTV, and a lot more are coming. One of them is Bottle Shock. And I think Bottle Shock is one of these movies that you've at least heard of if you drink wine. Right? I mean, this is a film you know of, you're aware of. And now it's kind of this film. Well, we're going to break down Bottle Shock. We're going to talk about it. And for better or worse, what its legacy is. This, as always, is brought to you by SomTV.com, which is our streaming network with a bunch of shows and programs and my blood, sweat, and tears drenched all over it. And so go to SomTV.com and check out what we have going. We're in a charter period, so the year is $74.99 right now. So it's, you know, it's like a expensive bottle in a restaurant. It's pretty much for 1 year worth of content. It's a good deal, right? Good. Okay. So today I am joined by Armin Khachaturian, who is, what is your title, Armin?
Director of Sales.
The Director of Sales at Clos du Vall Winery in Napa. Armin is, aside from being that, he's a really good friend. He has a cameo in Som 3 where he procures the bottle of 72 Clos du Vall.
Reserve Cab.
The Reserve Cab, right, which was a Judgment of Paris wine. I'm also joined by Nadine Netman, who is the Editorial Director of Som TV. The best. She is literally the best. She is the author of the Sommelier Mystery Series books, which you should be able to get. Where can you get these books?
They'll be on Amazon and iBooks and all that good stuff.
These are great. These are fantastic books. You guys, anybody who likes wine, even if you don't, you should get these. A sommelier uses her skills to solve murders, and it's pretty great stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, anyways, buy them. Okay. So we brought some wine to talk about Bottle Shock. Armin, what did you bring us?
I brought a bottle of 1972 Zinfandel from Clos du Vall.
Clos du Vall, 1972 Zinfandel. I just want to let you know, the whole reason I wanted to do this podcast is because I knew you would just bring something great. We could drink it. I mean, I don't, you know, that's the whole reason. So if you're listening to this, you know I'm just doing this so I can drink good wine.
Well, and it's funny because I had planned on bringing this bottle to drink with you anyways, because it's not Cabernet. We found some of this in the cellar. I thought it'd be kind of cool and fun. First vintage of Clos du Vall, they made some Zin off of Howell Mountain. And when you asked me if I had access to anything, I was at the airport, I was flying down, and I had this bottle, so it kind of worked out.
This is pretty badass. So 72, same vintage as the Judgment of Paris, which took place in Bottle Shock, which we will get to in a minute, but let's pour some wine. I want to drink this.
So the story of this wine is interesting because they...
72 Zin.
72 Zinfandel. So, wow, look at that color. So in 1972, Bernard Portin and his brother Dominic were starting to make wine at Clos du Vall as the first vintage. And we found this out from Bernard after we found the wine and had already opened it and tasted it. Apparently, a gentleman came knocking on their door and said, I have some Zinfandel fruit. And Bernard and Dominic looked at each other like, Zinfandel? They're from Bordeaux. They're French. What do they know about Zinfandel? And like, yeah, sure. Well, it was Howell Mountain and it was quote-unquote Zinfandel. Back then, it was field blend, right? The vineyards were planted to Petit Sirah, Carignan, and Zinfandel, and you got what you got. So they made it as if it was a Bordeaux red. And here we are 47 years later.
Cheers. Cheers. This smells ridiculous. This is so good. Yeah, it's impressive. I mean, this is in
good color,
perfect
that.
Shape. Okay. I wish all of you could taste this, but you can't because Armin doesn't share with you. Anyways, all right. So while we drink a 72 wine from a winery in the Judgment of Paris, let's talk about Bottle Shock, which is streaming right now on Som TV. Does this film rank in your top wine movies? If you were going to say films that are majorly about or consisting of wine region topics, would this sit in your top five?
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
Bottle Shock would.
Bottle Shock would definitely do that.
Okay. I would say it'd be my top three.
Top three? Yeah. I like that. It'd be my top five too. But, I said this. I mean, if you've listened to this podcast, it's like an ad nauseum. I did not start in the wine business. I didn't have parents who were like, you're going to be in wine or sell it or own a vineyard. I grew up in Cleveland. You know, so for me, Bottle Shock is a film that I kind of came to at a point when I didn't know shit about wine. I think it's, when was it?
2008.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, all right, maybe not. I was 28 when it came out then. Jeez, I'm old.
But it was like the first major wine movie that was like on the big screen. Sideways was first.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was about wine, but then there was so much more. But
we're talking like syringe into the pop culture, yeah. Kind of. All right. So Nadine, what is Bottle Shock about?
Okay, so Bottle Shock is basically about the 1976 Judgment of Paris and the leading up to that with Steven Spurrier gathering bottles of wine with Chateau Montelena. It is loosely based on the truth.
Loosely based on the truth. Now, it's unique because I just made Psalm 3. And of course, Psalm 3 is a film that looks at the Judgment of Paris, has a few people that were directly involved with the Judgment of Paris in it. Paul Draper from Ridge, my main man Steven Spurrier. Who else? Is there anybody else from The Judgment of Paris? I mean, we almost interviewed Bernard, but we ended up not. But a lot of wineries, though. Yeah. Maya Kamas, we filled at and all that stuff, filmed at. And so, ironically, in Psalm 3, the only winery we really didn't film at was Chateau Montelena. We happened to focus much more on the Reds in Psalm 3, which get no love. And so I think something kind of amazing about this film is that one winery sort of took it and made it their narrative. So first, I want to say, too, that I really like this film. So anything we say negative about this film is I think, in love for the most part, right? I mean, can we all agree on this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've all said we all love the film.
Because I'm going to talk some shit.
So you sit on that side of the table.
All right. So, no, but I mean, you know, there are certain things about this movie that now you look back at it and they kind of, there's both miracles in it and then there's ridiculous stuff. And we're going to cover kind of all that stuff. So let's start with the trajectory of this movie, kind of what you think it did to wine. And the reason you're here, Armin, is because you work in Napa. And this is a film set in Napa, about Napa. What's the story of Bottle Shock from the perspective of somebody in Napa? Do people still care about this movie? Do people watch it?
Yeah, it's entertaining, right?
Because Sideways, you mentioned it, and people go, they go, and they hiss, and they
freak
out.
Well, because Sideways did something. Sideways made people stop drinking a varietal.
Right. Well, I mean,
not stop, but
such nonsense. But
okay. Yeah, it is. But it did affect the industry. I mean, it made people start drinking Pinot, and it made people stop drinking as much Merlot. Fair to say. But Bottle Shock was different. Bottle Shock was entertaining, and I think as a movie, if it made people want to drink wine.
Yeah.
And if you look at a movie of what it did for the wine industry, if it made someone drink one extra bottle of wine, I think that's great. I think it succeeded. It wasn't a documentary. It wasn't supposed to be 100% accurate. It was entertaining. And I think...
Yeah, but it's not... Is it a film that anybody up where you are is like, you want to learn? Watch Bottle Shock.
No.
it's not a movie where it's like, oh, here, well, if you want to know what Napa's about and where to taste, then
sure.
Watch Bottle Shock.
No, but what's funny is you mentioned white wine, right? Judgment of Paris had two parts. It had the red wine aspect that we talk about all the time. This is about the white. And the only time they really talk about the red is at the end of the movie. If you haven't heard about the Judgment of Paris, yes, the U.S. winery wins that as well. But there's a little one line at the end that says, Stag's Leap wine cellars took first place in the red.
This was on the screen, right?
Yeah, that's all that there was about red wine.
Right.
Other than that, it was all about white wine. It was all about Chateau Montelena and a Chardonnay and a father and son and...
So, okay, but let's get into the actual plot. All right, so who's the main character of Bottle Shock?
Ooh, that is a very, very good question. I'm a huge Alan Rickman fan. So, like, I watched the movie for Alan Rickman, but, I mean,
I watched the movie for Chris Pine's wig. And that is the only reason you come to the movie for the wine, you stay for the wig, in my opinion.
I have complications on the wig.
No, we'll get to that.
It detracted for me.
Oh, you are wrong. That wig is perfect. Okay, so first of all,
your wig with or without the bandana? Because I think that made it worse.
Oh, no way. That made it better. I will have no blasphemy on Chris Pine's wig. I don't even believe it's a wig. That looks real to me.
I'm going to buy you that wig for Christmas.
I will wear that wig. I will wear that wig around Napa.
You're going to be Bo Barrett for Halloween.
My friends and I,
we cosplay this movie up in Napa all the time. I always want to be Chris Pine, but DeLynn will never let me. DeLynn is always Chris Pine. It's very unfair to me, to be honest with you. I always have to be Elijah Dusku's character.
Joe's awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so the main characters, we're going to go Chris Pine or Alan Rickman. Be those two?
I would say those two. Because, you know, Bill Pullman's not his main. Yeah. So Chris Pine or Alan Rickman. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I think it's Chris Pine's movie, right? I mean, it's Bo Barrett's the main character, no?
It's a
messy narrative for this reason. I mean, it's kind of a film where you're like, it's about a lot of things, I guess. All right. This film, if you look at, first of all, Rotten Tomatoes is total bullshit. I want to put this out right now. Rotten Tomatoes doesn't mean a goddamn thing. It doesn't matter what a Rotten Tomatoes score is, but I'm still going to tell you. It's 48% of the critics gave it a positive review.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who was it?
They crushed it. They crushed this movie. I mean,
I'm quite surprised at that.
I am too. I mean, I think the movie, and it's funny, these are not critics who are like, oh, they didn't get something right factually. I think most of them just, you know, they just ate this movie alive. And
are you sure that was on Bottle Shock or was that Wine Country? Because Wine Country got panned for a reason.
No, I'm looking at it right now. Wow. Bottle Shock. Critic consensus, 48% out of 121 reviews. This was back when films in theaters got reviewed by everybody.
Yeah.
Which now is like impossible. It's really hard to get a film unless you're Star Wars reviewed by everybody. So to have 121 reviews, I mean, the people, I mean, there's some trash reviews of this. I thought it was a charming film.
Yeah, it was entertaining. I mean, look, it's not an educational film. It's an entertaining film.
Right.
You want to spend an hour and 48 minutes and just watch something funny and
dude, entertaining? I think it's very good.
Crack open a bottle of wine and watch it.
Well, yeah, and for me, it's all about the underdog.
Sure.
I love that.
I mean, it's total bullshit. I mean, what happened is not. I mean, the fact that Montalena won and Stag's Leap won.
That happened.
Right. That happened.
And Steven Spurrier.
Spurrier existed as a human being.
Yes.
And did the Judgment of Paris.
Yeah. I don't know that anything else is true.
No, I don't think he went to a tasting and they were like, no, you don't have a seat here. Because he was pretty well established at that time. He probably lost business afterwards.
I've had a dozen conversations with Steven about all of these topics. And I put a little thing up on SomeTV, it's like 3 minutes long. That's just sort of his thoughts and then his wife being like, you know, relax, Alan Rickman played you in a movie. I mean, among the big issues for him personally was that Alan Rickman was 36 years older when he played him than he was in real life or something like that. I mean, he was in his 20s, I believe, when he did The Judgment of Paris. He's like 27.
I have to say, though, I can't see that role anyone other than Alan Rickman.
First of all, Alan Rickman is an earthly treasure. I mean, you know, movies are not the same without the guy gone. You don't even have to be a Harry Potter fan. I mean, Hans Gruber in Die Hard is one of the great villains in the history of cinema. And it happens to have happened in, like, one of the greatest action films of all time. But then it's not just that. I mean, you had Dennis Farina in this film. Oh, let's talk about the cast.
Okay.
I'm going to throw down something here. This is a candidate for the best cast of that entire decade in a film. So if you're thinking like the 2000s, oh, I'm serious. Look at the cast in this movie. Alan Rickman, Bill Pullman, Chris Pine, Rachel Taylor, the Australian girl who I will get to later. I have issues with her. Freddie Rodriguez and Dennis Farina.
And Elijah Dushku.
Miguel Sandoval, who has been in a ton of stuff. Bradley Whitford, who's like West Wing, big guy. Every single person in this movie, even the bit players, matter and they're important and they're recognizable. And some of them may not be like, you know, you were in Ocean's 11, but they're like recognizable. I watch TV. I know who you are. You have a name I recognize. I mean, this is a serious cast. Yeah. Everybody went on to do something. I mean, Chris Pine, he's in like Wonder Woman. Now he's a major, you know, he's a movie star. And when you see him in the movie too, you're kind of look at him and you're like, who is this? I mean,
he had done something.
What had Chris Pine done at this point?
I look it up. I'm not sure.
But you see him in this, and it's kind of like, who's this movie star? I mean, he's a movie star.
He is in the movie.
And even without the wig.
Yeah.
Actually, he had actually not done a lot before this new film.
That's what I'm saying.
I rescind my statement.
So what did Chris Pine do prior to Bottle Shock?
Prior to Bottle Shock, Smoking Aces, Blind Dating, Just My Luck, Surrender Dorothy, The Bulls.
All right, Smoking Aces was a relatively big film. Okay. Joe Carnahan. That was like an insane, you know, watching a movie on meth kind
of thing. One episode of 6 Feet Under, Confession, one episode of American Dreams, The Princess Diaries 2, Royal Engagement. I think he played a big role in that, actually.
Yes, he was the prince, I believe, or the guy that she fell in love with.
All right, so prior to this movie.
I have a kid, yeah.
Yeah, he's just like a good-looking guy that comes in and plays that role.
He had much shorter hair in Princess Diaries 2, I believe.
No wig.
So one of the great legacies of Bottle Shock is it gave us Chris Pine. It did.
But they got him for cheap.
Oh, this whole movie's budget is something like $10 million, which might sound like a lot of money. As somebody who has made some movies, not even close, not even a fraction of $10 million, I can tell you that in a narrative space, that is not much money. So there are some nitpicks people have about this film, like, oh, the end is not filmed in France. Oh, the shop and X and Y is probably a set and it's not really in Bordeaux. Well, I can tell you right now, $10 million with those actors is not enough to go to France, especially in those days when you shoot everything on film, you have gigantic crews that have to travel.
Hell, it wasn't even enough to go to Napa. Half those things were filmed in Sonoma because they're cheaper.
Well, so, and also supposedly there's a bunch of stuff filmed in Los Angeles. And, you know, it's a movie that, let's talk about what we like about Bottle Shock. What works?
I feel like this movie checks like three of my main points. Like, I like that it's, you know, underdog story. You're rooting for them. There's all these obstacles and everything. I like that. I like the cast. And then as like the third point, I like that it's about wine. I could not at the beginning watch this movie without opening a bottle of wine. Back in 2008, 2009, I didn't get really into wine until 2011.
Are there any movies about wine you don't like?
That is a very good question. There are ones I've watched that I haven't loved. But
okay, what are they? You're being really nice right now. What are they?
I am a nice person.
You are a wonderful person.
There were some documentaries I didn't like.
Like what?
Like Mondavino.
I fucking hated Mondavino.
Okay,
so
I didn't like that one. And then there were other wine movies that I'm not going to mention that I felt
plenty
missed
of people
the mark.
Plenty of people hated my films too, though. So trust me, it's subjectivity is why films are.
Whereas there's other
fun
wine films I love, like French Kiss, you know, and stuff like that.
So. Okay. Well, later, I mean, in a later podcast, we're going to do all of our top five wine films, and then our top five food films, because I think it's not fair to put those together, because I don't know that the wine film genre is the deepest lake. All right, so what works? Why do you like it, Armin?
So yes, it's about wine, right? That's probably the first. The scenery, it just makes you want to go out.
It's well filmed.
It's really well filmed. It makes you want to go out and be in the middle of vineyards.
It has a good score too, I'll be
honest.
Yeah,
the music really carries it.
And it has like the Doobie Brothers, right? When the film starts, it's got good period. The music's a little off period too, by the way. But
even you just hear some of that soundtrack, just like the instrumental, and you're like, you know exactly what movie you're in.
Yeah. Man, what a marketing piece for Montalena, huh? I mean, it's like, I wonder if, because Bo's in Psalm 1, and he's a very funny guy. I mean, it's funny. I could see him being like this character, you know, wild, crazy. I've heard some stories about him and Fred Dame back in the day that are not repeatable on a podcast. So I do know that he is he had a little bit of a wild thing. But I wonder if he ever got put gloves on and boxed his dad. I mean, they put quite
I think that's a lot more entertaining to watch than a father and son yell at each other. And right. I'm sure they yelled at each other.
Sure.
Right? Okay. You know, you got loans out. You're trying to make wine. No one knows what you're doing in Napa. Like, no one's taking Napa seriously. And, yeah, it's probably stressful. So I'm sure they yelled at each other. I don't think they built a boxing ring in the middle of a vineyard.
Well, and this gave it a nice visual medium.
It did, yeah, because it's a lot better than watching people yell. I think it had more of an impact.
No one in the valley wrecks more than three times. I do. Huh? Yeah?
Yeah. Whoa. Because if they didn't have that boxing scene or multiple scenes, then you'd be like, oh, well, you know, they just argued. But it was bigger. It was like their emotions.
All right, so how do you guys feel about, as a filmmaker, this is an interesting question for me, how do you guys feel about taking these kind of liberties in a movie?
Personally, I'm for it because I think poetic license. And you're carrying it in a visual medium. So I'm for that.
Okay.
If it's a documentary, no.
Yeah.
If it's a movie, absolutely.
See, that's not fair.
Why?
Because... why do documentaries, I, as a person who makes documentaries, I can tell you they're just as much bullshit as narratives. So, I mean, not mine. Mine are totally true. All of it. Everything. Like the driven snow. Everyone else's, though. You know? So it's one of these things where it's like narrative films, if there's an actor, you can suspend your disbelief. Whereas if you see an interview with somebody, automatically you go, this must be true. And if you find out it's not, then it's like not okay, I think. And Bottle Shock is a very interesting... it's a very interesting movie when you think about it in reality. They didn't pay Spurrier. His story was not licensed. He was pissed about this film. I mean, and it's some cojones from these producers. I mean, imagine if I was just to go, I'm going to make a film about Mark Zuckerberg and his story of starting Facebook. Now, they didn't license from him either, but it's still some cojones when you're taking a real person and you're going to tell that story and you're obviously going to, because Bottle Shock in a way is a biopic. It's a biopic of Montalena, I guess. See, the problem I have is, what is this film about? That's why I led the question led the podcast with, what is Bottle Shock about?
Because is it about Judgment Paris? Is it about Chateau Montalena? Is it about a father and son relationship? Is it about...
well, all movies have to have lots of different things, but in a log line, they always say the Judgment of Paris. And it really is not about the Judgment of Paris, as far as like a what actually happened. You know?
I feel like it's more about Napa and putting it on the map.
Yeah.
I know. And Sonoma's like, hey, can you put us on the map too while you're at it?
Yeah. Well, Sonoma.
Shock bottle.
Yeah.
Shock.
Well, no, but the funny thing is, so the filming, so I lived in Sonoma when this came out, and I actually saw it at the Sebastiani Theater. And, you know, they were selling wine, everyone's going to watch it. And I remember watching it, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's filmed right there at the square. The Toscano Hotel is in the square in the town of Sonoma. The little restaurant and the wine shop, that's part of Della Santina. It's a restaurant in Sonoma. You know, it's funny though, because it's a French bistro, but you see up on the restaurant dining room, it says Trattoria. It's the only thing I think they left. The owner, Robert Della Santina, I think it's his Italian way of saying, yeah, you want this to be a French restaurant? Yeah. Up yours. I'm gonna leave Trattoria up there, and no one's gonna know.
or they just went screw it on the production design and didn't have enough time to redo
to take it. Off, yeah,
who knows? I mean, so all right, the film itself, it grossed $3,939,185 off of a $10 million budget. That's not good. And from a profit standpoint, as a filmmaker, I can tell you, the filmmakers didn't make $4 million off this. You get about a third of what whenever you see a film grossed $100 million. Well, the theaters get somewhere in the realm of 40% to 60% of that. And then there's a number of other fees. And so films have to gross a ton of money. And back then, theatrical was a major part of how you made money. And then, of course,
was that the theatrical video, number?
That's theatrical. Okay. And I'm sure this movie crushed on home video. I mean, it had to. It came at a time when the DVD revolution was exploding. So there was just millions. I bet it made, I'm sure it has done fine.
Yeah, I did not see it in the theater. I saw it at home.
I saw it at home. I did not see it in the theater either. Because 2008, for all I know, I was filming some then. No.
No, that was 2 years before, a year before.
God, I don't know.
Yeah. We watched it at home, and like 30 minutes in, we paused it to open a bottle of wine. Because it made us want to drink wine. Yeah.
Christina and I remember my wife and I were kind of expecting this movie to be like, we were working on some, I think, at that point, and we tend to not watch. Everybody goes, oh, well, you must have loved Wine Country. And it's like, well, I still haven't seen Wine Country. I don't watch a lot of films that are about what we're making. She does. She'll watch, Christina will watch whatever. But I wasn't expecting much of this film. And I remember, I really loved it. First of all, I love Alan Rickman. I mean, I would watch Alan Rickman paint somebody's house. So, like, you talk about checking boxes. I mean, that Alan Rickman checks my boxes. I love him. So when I saw it, I kind of thought, this movie's hilarious. Plus, it was in a strange way, it's an anti-Sideways. I will make some enemies here, but I think Sideways is an amazing film. I think that director, Alexander Payne, I'll be on the record saying Sideways is an excellent, very well-made film, and it's very misunderstood. And an example of, as a filmmaker, you never know what people are going to take what you've made and do with it. I mean, Alexander Payne never meant to affect what the hell happened with people drinking Merlot and Pinot. I mean, it's ridiculous. Plus, if you know the ending, it's ridiculous. It's the inside joke was just not gotten, He's drinking Merlot at the end of the film. I mean, but it's an anti-Sideways, and that Sideways is a really dark movie. I mean, it's really dark. It's got some horrific, it's got a character that is very unlikable. Then you look at this movie, Bottle Shock, and it is a goofy kind of film.
I don't think there are any unlikable characters in Bottle Shock, are there?
I don't know. Not really. There are issues with the film, though. And, as a person who licensed it for SOMTV, I fought to get this movie. I really wanted this on our streaming platform because I think it is such a, I think it is a film that normal people should watch because it's funny and good and it makes you want to drink wine. But I think experts should watch it because it is a film that is like people's come to the table of wine. That's what they come with. So I think a lot of sommeliers and a lot of even winemakers, they're so far away from what the normal person walks into wine with that they should every once in a while come back and watch Bottle Shock, drink a, glass of grocery store wine, and come back to the table. But the film, as much as I love it, and as much as I think everybody should watch it, and kind of for a number of reasons, because what this movie's going to be in stone forever. It's always going to be on the list of wine films. Always. If you Google what wine film should I watch, it's going to be one of the top, if not the top. But I have some nitpicks with this film.
And it doesn't involve Chris Pine's wig, apparently.
I think, Chris, if you say anything bad about Chris Pine's wig anymore, let's talk about his wig for a second. You think that's a wig?
I 100% think that's a wig. And I will tell you, back in 2008, I did not know who he was. I was watching the movie, and I was like, wow, that wig is distracting. So.
I heard that he was able to grow that hair in 2 days for the part. That's how good he is.
It's called a wig.
If it was Chris Pinian and he was Armenian, he can grow it in 2 days. But no, he did not grow that hair in 2 days.
From his chest. I think you guys are insane. It's a perfect wig.
Okay, so what are your nitpicks then? Because it's not about the wig.
Okay, so all right. Now you guys better have some nitpicks too. If I'm going to do this, I want your nitpicks with this film as well. Okay.
Bring it.
So it's tough. I'll go with my main ones here. It's implied. So they have the Aussie girl, right?
Sam. You're calling the Aussie girl. She's not Australian in the movie, though.
Well, she's got quite an accent.
Yes, she does.
I made it.
Can I help you?
Yeah, I'm Sam.
And I'll be honest, let's start there. That is a very strong accent to not be Australian.
And the accent comes and goes. In some scenes, it's really strong. In some scenes, it's like, wait a minute, was that Australian accent?
It's a little inconsistent. I mean, yeah, I would say that that's a nitpick. Her accent is, it's Chris Pine's wig situation for sure. I also have some issues with, where's she supposed to be from?
Is that ever addressed?
Well, I have some issues with it. It's not addressed. She drives a car on three wheels because she has a broken wheel, which is funny. But where's she from? I don't know. I couldn't figure it out.
I watched it again, and I'm
sure. Like, where is this girl from? She kind of references where she was driving through.
Fairfield.
But that's, so she's from California?
I don't know.
I'm sure this is said, and someone's going to email us and say, look, idiot, you didn't notice. But, okay, here's my problem. Dennis Farina and Steven Spurrier are in their shop in Paris, or he's in Steven Spurrier's shop in Paris. And Dennis Farina's like hinting that, you know, you only have one Riesling and you only have X other wine and then the rest of it's French. You should have a more global outlook on wine. And he's like, yeah. And then he comes on, you know, Spurrier comes to say a few things that proves he knows a lot about wine in the film. Now, in real life, Jesus criminy, Spurrier knew a ton about wine. So this guy owns a wine shop and he has no idea that they are growing wine in California. No clue. But this girl, she drives up, she's in college, maybe like, I don't know, somewhere studying enology or something.
Yeah, because then they go to her professor, which was probably
UC Davis.
Exactly. No, so it's UC Davis.
Because they drive to ask the professor something, it shows a little sign, UC Davis, 2 miles.
Okay, so she goes, they go, why did you come here? They thought obviously she was going to be a boy.
With a name like Sam.
Right. Yeah. So she shows up, and her first reason that she wanted, they're like, why would you want to come to Montalena? And she's like, well, you guys have great terroir. And so the first problem I have is that this girl knows that Montalena has great terroir and uses that word. And then you've got a guy who's devoted his whole life to wine in Paris who has no idea. He references like, so what are they making wine in Chicago? And it's not a good look in my opinion. This is where wine, people automatically think wine is snobby. And it's the kind of like cliche character where like, I'm just using in relation to this student at UC Davis knows this obscure winery that's fighting for its life, has good terroir.
No, but the next line after that is you have good terroir and you're the only one that offered me the job.
Okay, but okay, in their defense, if she was at UC Davis, maybe they knew about Montalena at that point?
Well, what's Montalena's history?
Well, okay, 1882, Tubbs buys 254 acres, starts growing vines, makes wine, Prohibition, they stop. His kid, I think, takes over after Prohibition.
I thought Chateau Montalena was the one where when he bought it, they said there was only ghosts and spiders inside.
Yes, but okay, so but that's after. So what happened is after Prohibition, the Tubbs's nephew, son, cousin, family member starts the winery up again. It's run as winery for 20 years. He dies, and then the winery goes dormant. A couple, I believe he was an engineer. I don't know how to remember this stuff. They decide that that's going to be their little getaway home, their retirement home. They buy it, and the Barrett family, along with another family, buys this winery. At that point, it's already called Chateau Montalena. Montalena because of Mount St. Helena, Montalena. That's where that name came from. Started doing Chardonnay, and they didn't really do Cab until the late 70s, I think 78. So, I don't know, were they known at UC Davis? Maybe they went there and said, hey, help us out. What do we do?
I mean, the building had been there since the 1800s. I mean,
1882,
you know, So you've taught, you know, it's Tromsburg's 20 years prior, and that's by Calistoga. You know, you had wineries over there, and you had structures that were built, so people would have been aware of them, sure. But I don't know. I have some issues with that character.
Yeah.
That gal, the not Aussie student.
The not Aussie.
Who's clearly Australian in every scene she's in. You know, why does every character except for Bill Pullman have to sleep with her in the film? Can we talk about this? Is this appropriate?
Two characters slept
with her.
Is
that liberating that she gets to do that, or is that a bad look? You as a woman, how do you feel about that?
So Gustavo and...
Who we should talk about, by the way. He's a real person, real winemaker.
He is.
All right, well, hold on. So let's go. I brought up, and I'm going to get buried for this, but...
Yeah, we had Gustavo and Bo both slept with her.
Right.
I didn't love that part of the movie. I'm not going to lie. Because I feel like it's so empowering with Jo at the bartender. She's, you know, Liza Dushku, and she's powerful and, you know, everything. And then you've got Sam, who appears to sleep with anyone who has good wine. So I don't love that part, but it ended okay.
Yeah, it's not a really good look in my
opinion. No, I don't love that.
I think.
But I also, it could be looked at as like she's not bound to anybody and she's her own person and she can bang who she wants. I mean, like, meaning,
yeah,
like,
true.
Maybe it should be looked at that way. And that's why I brought it up is like, am I feeling weird about this and that's my problem? Or am I feeling weird about this because that's the film's problem?
Well, and I think there's going to be many people who watch it like, oh, you go, girl. And they're going to be excited for her, like, doing whatever she wants right. as a free spirit, you know?
Right. I'm married with kids. And so obviously.
Well, you have two girls. So you look at different things differently.
Maybe I'm watching it and thinking, you know, behave yourself. But at the same time, I also, you know, I don't know.
I was rooting for Joe.
Yeah, Joe's great. All right, then the last thing, which is going to bring us to Freddy here, the blind tasting. The blind tasting scenes in this movie are just awesome. I mean, the one that happens in the Cave du Madeleine or whatever, in the wine shop that Steven Spurrier has with Dennis Farina and George. Spurrier. Yeah, George.
Yeah, with George Tabor as
George
well.
George Tabor.
Oh, and George Tabor.
Yeah.
Those are, so, yeah, George Tabor, yeah. God, this movie's great. All right, so, but that one's okay. You know, that's kind of how people talk about wine. But the one where they bet money and throw money on the bar, and he's going to say what percentage of Merlot's in the blend, what percentage of Cabs in the blend, the vintage, all this stuff. As someone who has definitely not shied away from blind tasting, I find the scene amazing.
Well, no, but at the end of the scene, you see that it's a hustle.
Yeah, I thought you were going to go with the Cheval Blanc or one of them first. Yeah. That you think Joe switched it?
Yeah, Joe switched, but he still got it. Yeah.
But it's right? But it's like the way I'm just saying the way it's done.
Sure.
is kind of you know, like swishing it around between your teeth like that. I don't know. Am I wrong? Did that look legit? You're a certified sommelier.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you've got like Fred Dame who picks up the glass and goes and identifies the wine.
All right, look, there's a little bit of lore with that one. I don't know how true that is either, no matter how much I perpetuated that story.
No, but I mean, I've been in lots of blind tasting groups. Some people can do it really fast. Others go through the deductive tasting method and go slower.
Okay, but the problem with blind tasting, in my view,
yeah.
I'm not a somm. I support the guild. I love what they do. It's all about education. But when I see two people, somms, that get together in front of each other and they're going to blind taste each other, the first thing they do is they start thinking, all right, what would you blind taste me on?
Right,
so then all
I mean,
of a sudden they start bringing that
yeah,
in.
But also, like, I've been put in blind tasting situations where I haven't known anything about the person who was going to give me the wine. So that you aren't taking those clues. I'm literally just looking at the hints in the wine glass.
See, that's the best scenario when you have no idea who's doing that because it takes that out of the equation, right? But the other part of it is you have good days and you have bad days.
All right, look, well, they had to do exposition in the film to show a blind tasting, what it is, why, you know, because at that point, I mean, Jesus, had anybody seen blind tasting in a film
no.
at all? I mean,
no.
I just throw it around like it's nothing now in my movies. But like, so I guess, I mean, I think it's a little ridiculous, that whole scene, just how
it
comes
fun
down.
Scene, yeah.
It's fun, but Christina can't handle that scene. She just loses her mind whenever, you know, it's not like we watch this film every like week, but what do you guys got? You got to have some nitpicks in here. Right. Aside from like it's not filmed in France at the end and all those things.
Oh, okay. So I'm looking at it and I'm like, wow, they have an audience? I mean, it wasn't set as to have an audience. They were kind of there.
Are you talking about Judgment of Paris?
Yeah. Okay. In Bottle Shock at the end, they're all sitting on stage.
Well, they're in that outdoor French courtyard.
And you know, they have this audience. And it's funny because at one point it pans up, there's these little kids eating a baguette, right? First of all, yes, kids will eat baguette if you give it to them, but they're not going to sit there and watch grown people taste wine. That's not entertaining. They're going to be out running around, you know.
There's a few cliches, French cliches in this film.
But even French kids aren't going to sit there and eat a baguette watching adults blind taste. I watched that. I remember I'm looking going, hold on, why was that scene even there?
I set the scene now, and Jason's going to have his daughters eat baguettes next time there's blind tasting going on.
100%. It's happening. Let me ask, I have another potential nitpick here. When they're first introduced, Bo and his father, and they're boxing, and they're talking about racking wine, and they're punching each other like, most people only rack wine three times. Like, well, we're going to rack it five times. He punches them again.
Yeah.
They're talking about racking their white wine.
So it's clear.
Let me ask you about racking white wine. I've seen a lot of, you know, you go to Rioja and they rack a lot. They rack their red wine mostly. Do you see a lot of people that are racking their white wine at all?
No.
Do you rack white wine? You can, right?
I mean, you can.
Who does it?
I have no idea.
I've never seen anybody.
I've never been like, what? So do you, like, that's not a question. I'm like, so, okay, what's your oak percentage? What's the alcohol in the wine?
That makes sense.
You know, how many times you rack
it? I mean, people must rack. I mean, I know that wine of all kinds can be racked.
Sure.
But I just don't understand why you would rack a white wine.
To filter it?
Yeah, but
without a filter in 73?
But what wines, I mean, it's different. A white sure. wine doesn't have the same kind of particles in it. I'm completely wrong.
Well, okay,
wrong.
Unfiltered like, white wine versus filtered white wine. Unfiltered white wine tends to be
racking
really
it five times. Racking a Chardonnay five times that you're in a barrel.
Okay, if they didn't have any machines and it's all done by hand and gravity, and it's like, okay, we're gonna put the stick there with the hose. We know where the lees are. We want to make sure we don't get any of the cloudiness and want it to be really clean. Maybe
five times.
I'm trying to get people to
back. I wonder if they get that question a lot at Chateau Montelena. Yeah. Like tourists come and they're like, "How many times do you rack your wine?"
I bet nobody's ever even thought twice or cared about that.
I want to go there now and ask that question.
I think that's
their wine, their Chardonnay, I will say, is very good.
I think
Montelena Chard is really good wine.
But I think anyone who's listening to this should go to Chateau Montelena and say, "So, how many times do you guys rack your Chardonnay?"
And also, do you have Chris Pine's wig?
I would like
to try it on.
You're so obsessed with that wig.
I love it.
You're 100% getting
cosplay.
That for
I can't wait to cosplay this movie with my friends, Dylan, and everybody.
We're going to put this video up on some TV. Bring it. Cosplaying.
That's fine. I will. I have this. There's a dead possum outside my house. I'm going to put it on my head, and I'm going to be Chris Pine.
You should go to the Smithsonian, where they have the display of the 73 Chateau Montelena and the 71,
I think. Is it 71 Stags?
No.
72?
72 is our first vintage. I think 74 was...
I should know this.
But go to where the display is of the Smithsonian, of the two bottles of the Judgment of Paris, and grab that wig and just put it right next to it.
That wig should be in the Smithsonian.
It belongs in the Smithsonian.
It should be in the Smithsonian.
Just so you'll be at ease.
You know, I also think... I feel a little bad for the real Steven Spurrier in that this event... It really helped him, I'm sure, in a lot of his endeavors that he could point to something he did. I mean, it's kind of like now, it doesn't matter what movies I make, it's always going to be like, I'm the guy who made some. And I feel like I'm stuck with that as my moniker.
It's not a bad moniker.
No, it's not. It's great. I love it. But
you could have made Waterworld.
Do you know how much I wish I had made Waterworld? I will not have you talk anything bad about Waterworld or Chris Pine's wig in my podcast. Okay, so I want proof it's a wig. Okay, so what was I talking about? You guys got me off track. I was thinking about Waterworld, talking about, what are we talking about?
Oh, the wig, Smithsonian, the vintage.
Spurrier. No, so Spurrier is, he didn't make any money off this. You know, this wasn't something that, like, they charge admission. And I think the biggest hit that really pissed him off about this. Now, this is movie aside. I love the movie. I think the movie's great. And I also agree with you, Nadine. I don't think filmmakers, I don't think they need to apologize for taking liberties based on making a film when they have to do something.
Well, I feel like documentary, you're showing something factual. And when it's a film like this, you're just telling a story for enjoyment.
Right. I mean, there could be a spin on something factual, right. Perspective. Okay, fine. With a movie, look, they wrote based on true events. But then again, so did the movie Fargo. And they lied. There's no true events at the beginning. You know, but the movie Fargo starts with based on true events. And it goes to show like how much bullshit, you know.
Is there no wood chipper in real life?
No, probably not. But they did it. So when that comes up and you're watching Fargo, you're like, holy crap. Now, they put it at the beginning of Bottle Shock for the opposite reason. So Spurrier couldn't sue him based on true events. So it's a very interesting thing. So Spurrier, his biggest issues with the film, like the ones that truly, truly bugged him, wasn't the age. It wasn't that Alan Rickman was older. It was that the plot was his store was failing in Paris. And so the whole reason the film exists from a story plot forward standpoint is that Spurrier has to find a way to make money through a big ticket kind of gimmick. And that's this tasting. And that really ticked Steven off because actually it was doing very well.
And after he did the tasting, a lot of vintners in France were like, we're not going to sell any more wine to you.
Yeah, he...
There were a lot of people upset with him. So Aubert de Valens was a vintner there at the same time. So he probably said, hey, I'll still keep selling you my stuff.
Wasn't he? He was a judge.
He was a judge, yeah. But he was. I think there were two vintners.
I think some of the judges got some...
All the judges got.
Pushback.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, the other thing, they missed a big opportunity in this film. Because they have Dennis Farina, who is like one of the greats. I mean, honestly, if you're a character actor guy like I am, where you like certain, you follow certain people... I mean, Dennis Farina, like as Jennifer Lopez's father and Soderbergh's Out of Sight, he's like the greatest one-line king in that movie. He's in so many classic, incredible films where he plays a cop or some dirty street guy or whatever. He's a truly great actor. That being said, There's a woman by the name of Patricia Gallagher who gets no credit whatsoever and should have been in this film. She was the person who was really responsible for picking a lot of the wines that were in the American ones. And she lives in Paris. We have something coming up in the hopefully not too distant future that is going to get deeper into this topic, where we will interview her and interview Tabor and all this stuff and kind of do a documentary on the real story of this. But I really wish they had done somebody played by Patricia. I mean, if I had my salt, our Aussie gal, non-Aussie gal, would have gone, and we would have had Patricia Gallagher played by somebody, you know, Meryl Streep. I mean, Jesus, the cast is good enough anyway, why not? And like, you know, but you should have had this role, because she was the one who went to, her and Steven were the ones who said, look, let's do this. You know, I don't want to lose Dennis Farina, but right. It's a valid, that I think that's what really.
If they didn't really, may not have done a lot of research, because they didn't know Steven Spurrier was still alive when they decided to make this movie. So yeah. They may not have known Patricia was even involved.
I mean, that's some shoddy research. I mean, if you're going to make a film about something and you don't know that somebody's alive, you know, that's kind of shame on them. But all of this aside, every movie has this kind of stuff. You know, we could play this game with, even Waterworld has errors, Armin. Even Waterworld is not a perfect film.
You're the one who thinks it's perfect.
You're damn right I do. We should break down Waterworld just to piss off podcast listeners. Why the hell is the next episode about Waterworld?
It's a miracle, right? Water to wine.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do we drink
to keep the party going?
Waterworld?
Yeah.
Because, by the way, this wine is fantastic.
Oh, this wine is ridiculous.
Opening up.
Yeah, we should talk about the 72 Zinfandel for a second. It's not the oldest Zin I've had. I've had some Zinfandels from the 50s from Sonoma. But this is probably the best old Zinfandel I've ever had, for sure.
No, it's fantastic.
Miraculous shape. I would be very curious what people would think this was. And on the wine, on the Judgment of Paris wine situation, I guess, you know, this is out of left field. But I've been lucky enough to have a lot of the wines. Now, obviously, their current status, and many of them have been from the winery and things like that, or collectors. And that 72 Côte d'Aval that we opened in Somme 3 is one of the best American wines I've ever had. I don't even know that you need to have the moniker American. It's one of the best wines. It was amazing. And this 72 Zin, how many bottles of this are left?
So Ted Henry, our winemaker, comes in one day and he's holding up these bottles and he's like, hey, check out what I found. And I knew Côte d'Aval made Zin in the 70s and 80s, but I'm looking going, does that say 72? He's like, yeah. I'm like, where'd you find that? He goes, in the middle of this pallet we were breaking down. And on the bottom, there's like, you know, 30 bottles of this 72 Zin. And Ted and I tend to just say, shit, open it. And we do that a lot. We find something, it's like, hey, open it. How is that drinking? So we grabbed our Durand and started pulling the cork out. And we're like, wow, that's really good. And then we do a second one. And we're like, oh my God, that's really good. And then we start looking. And I had this bottle in my office, in my little wine fridge. And I was like, you know, we don't. Zin is not our thing now, but it's...
Do you guys still make a Zin at all?
We make a little Zin and we export it. It's not for the U.S. market, but yeah, it's this fun little wine. So about a week later, we were having a meeting with the winery and Bernard was there for the meeting. And I was like, Ted, let's blind taste Bernard. And I was telling Ted the history of old Zinfandel in California, how a lot of it was fuel blend. And they would plant Zinfandel, Carignan, Petit Sirah. They would blend it. They'd have different blends. And I'm like, this is not a Zinfandel that we know today. I mean, what's the alcohol in it? 13%? It's not an 18%, 17%, 16% Zin. And we end up tasting this with Bernard. And the first thing he says is he starts telling the story of this guy came and offered us some Zinfandel. And we didn't want to say no. We were new in town. It was our first vintage. We wanted to be a good guests. And so they ended up picking up some of this Zin and making it. Yeah, some of these old Zins that you come across, the old Côte d'Aval stuff, 78, 79, 83, they're showing really well.
No, that's great.
It's delightful.
The wine's ridiculous. And so I'm looking at the list of wines in the Judgment of Paris. I mean, because Bottle Shock was only on Montelena. I mean, you just get a shot of Ridge. I think Alan Rickman's Tasting Ridge. You get a shot of Côte d'Aval at the airport. I think that's really it. You don't see any other labels.
Yeah. Well, except for the ones that they do the blind tasting on and she pulls the... Oh, but not from the Judgment. Never mind.
Yeah, those are French, I think.
Right?
One's a Bordeaux.
One's a Ridge.
Oh, right. One is a Ridge from that blind tasting. Yeah. That's right.
One was...
Cheval Blanc.
Yeah, one was a 47 Cheval Blanc.
47 Cheval Blanc. It's legendary. Yeah. Legendary.
And there's a 59 Cause d'Estrenau that they drink in the movie at the restaurant.
Try to think of the third wine they blind taste on.
Answers like a lullaby at the tip of my tongue. Sonoma, Pinot Noir, 1962, Buena Vista.
So looking at it, you look at the reds, Stag's Leap.
Stag's Leap Wine Cellars.
Stag's Leap, yeah. Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. Yeah, we know the whole, well, there's an interesting story between those two.
Yeah.
Ridge Vineyards, Heights, Côte d'Aval, Mayacamas, and Freemark Abbey. So every single one of those, though they may not still be owned by the same people, some are. And all of these are top-notch wineries still in Napa. The whites are interesting. Yeah. The whites are insanely interesting. And I bet you, if I were to ask most people, let me try this. Can you name the whites that were in the Judgment of Paris?
Unfortunately, I cannot.
Can you name any? Obviously, you can name Montalena.
Montalena.
Can you name any others? This is the magic of this film. Montalena is the only white anybody thinks of. And they did a great rubber stamp with this film. They basically, they showed the world that only they existed. What else? Can you name any whites?
Chalon.
Yes, Chalon is correct.
Was Mount Eden?
Nope.
No.
Keep going. You can get one more, I promise you.
Give him a hint. I have no idea what it is.
One, there's one red that has a white.
Courage?
Nope. Freemark Abbey.
Freemark Abbey white, really?
Wow.
Yep, so they did the Freemark Abbey white, Viter Crest.
Oh, yeah.
Spring Mountain Vineyard, and you said Chalon, which Chalon, I mean, is a really fascinating one to have chosen. But here's the most interesting one, David Bruce Winery. And I am so fascinated. Does anyone know where David Bruce Winery is?
Sonoma, Dry Creek.
It is in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Oh, David Bruce.
Above Silicon Valley. And they are one of these wines that it just doesn't seem to make much sense that it was picked. And nobody talks about it. And it's just an interesting one. Where's Chalon? This is another one. So Chalon Winery is south of San Francisco. And it is not in any wine region. It is not in any wine region that you would say is a really famous kind of thing. So if you look at it, it is found, it's in the Chalon AVA, which is in Monterey and San Benito counties of California.
Wow.
This wine isn't in Napa. It's not in Sonoma. It's not in Santa Cruz. It's in the Chalon AVA. This is just the most fascinating thing to me that they've chose this wine. And I think it does go to show either the lack of knowledge or the incredible experimentation of the people picking the wines, because they may have just been casting a wide net and saying like, look, I mean, obviously they tasted all the wines. They thought it's great. And there's quite a bit of wine from this area. It's just not what people think of.
So back in the mid 2000s, when I was at Hansel Vineyards, we had dinner with Gene Arnold Sessions, the president of Hansel at the time. Bob Sessions, in my opinion, one of the best winemakers ever. He actually made the wine at Mayacamas with Bob Travers.
The wine from the Judgment of Paris.
Yes.
Yes.
And
we are filming something with Mayacamas coming up on that particular wine.
That's awesome.
Very excited.
And George Tabor. This is after he had written that the book. The book.
Yeah. Which is a very good book.
It is. And we're having dinner, and one of the questions that Gene asked was, why these wines? Like, do you know why Steven Spurrier chose these wines? And he had said that he didn't choose wineries that were well established. He wanted to choose wineries that were doing some interesting things, which is why he didn't choose the Chardonnay from Hansel, even though Hansel was making wine from the 53 vintage. You know, there was no Mondavi in that tasting. He was choosing wineries that he thought were doing some interesting things.
Well, this Chalon, which is, again, from an AVA that is far from Napa, south of San Francisco, it was number three. It was the third white wine out of 10. It took third.
Yeah.
And it's funny that this winery, I'm sure if you go to taste there, it's all over the place that they were in the Judgment of Paris, but nobody knows outside of, you know, unless you're looking on Wikipedia, you know, it's not known. So,
well, I mean, okay, let's
so take there's, the... So there's a lot of stories still to be told about the Judgment of Paris. And I think a lot of people make the mistake of thinking, oh, the Judgment of Paris is just this, and it is, by the way, a marketing tool for American wines. But it's not just that. There are stories of some people who were breaking their backs to try to make great wine at this time. And there's a lot of angles. I mean...
Yeah. Well, I think most people know about the Judgment of Paris from Bottle Shock.
Yes.
And so, like, there's a whole avenue there for people to know more, know what actually happened.
Well, what do you think they call the Judgment of Paris in Paris?
They don't have a name right? for it.
They don't talk about it.
Yeah.
I guarantee they're not sitting there like, hey, guess what? But we use it every chance we get.
Yeah.
And every sixes, right? Whether it's 86, 96, 06, 16... they do some sort of tasting around the country of guess what?
Well, our episode of Verticals coming up has Paul Draper open up the 71 that was in there. And it's a, oh boy, it was good. Anyways, I think it's worth it. I mean, why wouldn't you mention it? Why not?
Yeah.
I've talked about this before on the podcast, and I happen to be, as a story seeker, I'm always looking for stuff to talk about, stuff to make movies about, whatever the hell. And so the Judgment of Paris is a really fascinating thing. You got a you got the same kind of thing where you had like the British invasion and all these different bands forming. And then you had all these bands in Laurel Canyon coming about and learning from each other. And then in the wine business, you have all these people learning from each other and fighting and things are changing. And it was just a time where everything was alive. And it happened in cinema at the same time. I mean, late 60s through the 70s is just some of the greatest, most revolutionary stuff that's ever happened in art and in wine. And in, so that I continue to find myself drawn back to The Judgment of Paris as a fascinating story. Sense, you know, to come back and find it, it's why wouldn't you talk about it, you know?
Well, you do, and the reason you do as well is because you know the United States needed to validate what they were doing, and they got that. It validated all their hard work.
Well, is it so at this time, what else are the major events in your opinion besides the Judgment of Paris that happened around the same time?
The bicentennial,
right? So 1776, fine. Yeah. Okay, but for a wine perspective, I mean, the Schramsberg going to...
Sure, to China.
Going to China.
Peace, yeah. Yeah,
with Nixon.
Yeah, shameless verticals plug on Schramsberg as well.
That was actually really good, by the way.
Thank you. But I think that was really important to show American wine was good, or at least put it on the radar. I mean, it wasn't a quality thing. It was more of a, let's use American wine instead of something else. Mm-hmm. The Judgment of Paris. What else? What am I missing in this time period that really set things on fire? I mean, you had like Burns Steakhouse and the Sarnin Factory kind of go into war with wine lists and upping their game, and they bought a ton of American wine. And I think a lot of people went to those wineries and had American wine and thought, wow.
Well, okay, you had Robert
also
Mondavi.
Also, Windows on the World. Yeah.
But you had Robert Mondavi, who's out there telling a story. And I think that's really important.
Okay. Yeah. Could not agree more. Yeah, Mondavi would have to be maybe more so than definitely more so than the Judgment of Paris, as far as a person who
helped put Napa
shoved
on the map,
shoved a bomb Napa into that concept of American wine is great.
Yeah,
because even friends who never like heard anything about wine, they all know who Mondavi is, even if they don't know anything else.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There was the they call this the class of 72. There's a bunch of wineries that started up in 1972. Stag's Leap Wine Cellars is one of them. Clos de Vaux was one of them.
Well, Clos de Vaux was French origin. You know, Bernard and his brother, they're from Bordeaux. And I know that because Stephen has told me that was a lot of motivation for picking them. You had French winemakers in Napa. How would that do? What would their style be like? Could that trick the judges? You know, I know that that's what he was aiming at with Clos de Vaux.
So, yeah, 72 was the class 72 was Chateau Montelena, Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. You had Diamond Creek.
Yeah.
You had Camus.
Boots and Al Brownstein.
Sure. You had Camus then. You had Burgess.
You know, people underestimate the fact that the Brownsteins at Diamond Creek had the first $100 bottle of wine.
Yeah. Not
Napa.
Opus 1. No, Diamond Creek.
That's, I mean, they were selling Diamond Creek for $100 when? In the... years before Opus, I think it was at least a couple years before Opus started.
Well, they're class 72, so they started in 72.
Diamond Creek's a great, that's a great
Opus was 79, right? You had Edmeads and Dry Creek Vineyard. There's a lot of Mount Eden.
And these are all wines. Everyone you're mentioning are wines that just age so well. So there's something about the way they started making wines at that time. I mean, it's no coincidence these old ridges and these old Clos de Vaux and these old... You know, Stag's Leap Wine Cellars, they age, they're incredible wines to go the distance.
I mean, Silver Oak was 72 as well.
Oh. Wow, I forgot about Silver Oak, yeah. All right, so back to Bottle Shock. If you're going to do a revisionist Bottle Shock and you could pick a different winery than the one they focused on, which winery from The Judgment of Paris do you make it about? A bunch of hippies on the top of Ridge, some French guys at Clos de Vaux.
That would actually be funny. Because then, you know, do the French beat the French, or?
Well, I mean, obviously, the only other one you could have done where there's a winner would have been Stag's Leap, and Warren would have been an interesting character.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, who would you choose? I mean, if you chose any other one, they don't win.
No, they don't. That's the thing. So you have to choose the winner.
Yeah, because the story's about winning. Yeah.
And, well, you know, the other thing, too, is the wineries weren't involved in it, other than they gave their wine.
Sure.
So it'd be hard to have a story where you kind of see you make bad guys and good guys out of different wineries because there wasn't... That's actually kind of a good thing this movie did. There's no bad guy, really.
No.
Is there?
No.
Maybe that's a flaw in the film, but it's a good thing in the way it's presented. Who's the bad guy? It's got to be a bad guy, right?
There's not, though.
The bill collectors? The guys who are going to foreclose on Montelena?
Honestly, like, the only banker. Thing I could think
the
of...
Bankers are always bad guys.
Just, like, something maybe a little bit with the wine, like how they had, like, the bottle shock, how it went brown. Like, that could be, like, a part of a villain. But other than that, like, there's not really a villain in the movie at all.
Maybe it was the French thinking that American wine suck.
Yeah, but they didn't. I mean, to be very frank, I think that whole thing is bullshit. I have never met a French person in my life who's like, American wine sucks. I mean, every single one of them, like, you bring a bottle, they're like, oh, awesome. And they open it, they drink it, and they go, this is great. I've never in my life with the greatest winemakers and then just, you know, new winemakers and all sorts of different facets.
Yeah, but
of,
what was the scene in 1976?
They would have gone, they never would have been like, American wine must suck. They would have just been like, oh, there's wine over there, cool. I don't think they would have looked at this as, I mean, look, you got to over-dramatize this stuff. You know, you have to.
Okay, if I brought you the wine French, from the French Arizona, you might be like, wine from Arizona? And I'd be like, yeah, wine from Arizona.
I happen to have had some good wines from Arizona.
I have as well. But you take wine from Arizona, someone, they're not going to be like, oh, great, wine from Arizona. They're going to be like, wine from Arizona. 40 years later, right, in the future, they might be like, oh, yeah, wine from Arizona.
But the, I don't know, I think... In today's world, it's not like this. I think in today's world, somebody goes, they're making wine in Siberia. People are like, holy shit, I want to try that. How the hell are they doing it? They're making wine in Sweden. They're making wine in Armenia. They're making wine in Finland, whatever. It doesn't matter where you mention. Someone's going to go, I haven't had it. I want to try it. So, and I truly believe the French would have been like that. I do. And also, the other thing is, understand, it's really the woman who did the planning with Stephen. She was American, Patricia. So it's a pretty strong misrepresentation to have, like, that whole, like, oh, they grow wine in Chicago kind of thing, when, like, it's just a gross misrepresentation of, like, what actually...
But it's a funny line.
Oh, it's a very... All right,
because he talks about Chicago, and right away, Dan's
like,
goes, I'm from Milwaukee.
Yeah. I'm from Milwaukee, yeah, of course. And you want to know something? They do grow wine in Illinois, and they do grow wine in Wisconsin.
Okay, they
definitely
grow
do.
Grapes in every state.
Every state, yeah. They make wine in Alaska.
They do.
Make wine in Hawaii.
They do. They make wine in every state.
Some of it is really bad.
Yeah. And some of them, it's really bad. They sell a lot.
Oh, because I'll tell you right now, and anybody listening to this can agree, I don't care who you are. If you are tasting at a winery, it's usually really pretty.
Yeah.
And you're usually with somebody you like. And so you're going to have a decent time.
Also, when you have that wine the next time, you're tasting the memory.
Yeah, that's true. Especially if it's a place that has good wine, you know what I mean? I mean, if it is a Napa, Sonoma, Santa Barbara, but I mean, you know, now all of a sudden you're starting to realize it's a nature nurture thing. It's like with wine, is it nature or is it nurture? And if you ever have children, you know, it's not either and it's not one and it's not both. And it's kind of same with like great wine can be made in the Finger Lakes. Great wine can be made in Ohio. Great wine can be made in Michigan. But do great winemakers want to do it in Ohio? Maybe not. So they go to Napa and they go to Santa Barbara because it might be a little easier and it might be
in Oregon. Because right? you have Oregon, a lot of great Burgundy producers go to Oregon.
Oregon makes
But I think wherever you go,
wine.
There's
Washington makes great wine. I mean, there are truly great. What were you saying?
Oh, wherever you go, there's going to be great wineries and not great wineries, even in California. So,
right,
yeah. Sure.
All right, so what's your winery you're taking if you're going to remake Bottle Shock?
I would do Clos de Vaux. I'd like to see French winemakers, yeah. You know, that grew up at Chateau Lafite. You know, it'd be an interesting twist. Bernard and his brother grew up in France. Their father
no conflict of interest for you working at Clos de Vaux.
Got to keep a job.
Yeah. What about you?
I would have to do one of the winners because that to me is the story. It's about, as I said, the underdog and then winning and overcoming triumph, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, and Paul Draper had too much hair. You wouldn't need the wig, so I couldn't do Ridge. Even though Ridge would be my choice, I would love to find an actor to play a young Paul Draper.
But see, I think what was great about the movie was they chose a white.
No, I agree.
And that's the twist, that every other discussion about Judgment of Paris goes to red. This was about Chardonnay. And you know what? It's nice. It's nice that Chardonnay got a little something. Chardonnay got a little recognition.
When we interviewed Bo in Psalm 1, he doesn't have much hair left.
No.
I wonder if that's the motivation for the wig. If he was like, listen, I want this wig to be big. And they probably brought several versions for Bo to take a look at. I can see Bo going, no, we need more wig.
I'm not even waiting till Christmas to buy this for you. Like, you're going to get it next week.
I cannot wait for Psalm 6, Bo Barrett's hair. See, it comes off the tongue perfectly.
So he more hair... And more cowbell.
Less cowbell, more hair. That's my bumper sticker says on the back of my car.
That'd be funny. Less cowbell, more hair. Chateau Montelena.
Love it. I love it. I'm going to go buy a bottle of Chateau Montelena and drink it with a wig on tonight. This is great. This is fun to do this. Any last thoughts on the movie?
Favorite quotes.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, favorite quotes. I have several, but I'll try and narrow it down to one. When Alan Rickman's in the bar and he says, all these California wines.
Oh, so good.
What were you expecting? Thunderbird?
And she just turns on her heels and walks away. And I'm like, yes. So there's my favorite one.
That's a good one.
I like it, Thunderbird. Probably at the end of the movie. When Time Magazine calls for a quote, and he's not expecting it, right? And he turns around, he's like...
I'd have to say that it's not bad for kids from the sticks.
That's great.
I like that.
That's
I like Rickman's line where he says, why don't you like me? Finish it, Nadine. Give me the line.
So, because you think I'm an asshole, and I'm not really. I'm just British, and well, you're not.
Yes, that's my favorite line in the film. Definitely. Oh, it's so great. And Spurrier would never swear. I'm serious. This guy's so proper and wonderful. I mean, he might swear privately, but I can't picture it. And if he did, you wouldn't hear it because it would be so graceful. All right, this has been fun. If you have SOM TV, watch Bottle Shock. Get people together. It's a good film. It's a great film, actually. And if you don't have SOM TV, for the low cost of $74.99, you can provide food for a poor filmmaker. I'm almost out of wine and I need your help, guys. Anyways, SOMTV.com. New shows, movies, all sorts of stuff. But good stuff, everybody. Be safe.